Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
We love LA.
Blame it on the rain.
Throwback?
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Make Me Smart. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and special guest star.
I'm being extra quiet so I can trick you. No, I'm totally here. I'm back. I was just messing with you guys. Hey, oh, I'm Molly Wood. Back after these many weeks of vacationing and flitting around at conferences and such. So excited to rejoin you because, as it turns out, in a tagline I may or may not have completely forgotten during a panel recently, none of us is as smart as all of us. In fact, I needed my producer to shout it at me.
There you go. Did she really shout it? That's so embarrassing.
Yeah, it was not good. I'm glad I went ahead and just copped to it here. Get that out of the way.
God. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to get to the actual Make Me Smart part of this thing, in which we talk to an outside person who knows a lot about something, and it's something that's going on in this economy right now. We're going to talk to a guy by the name of Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent of the New York Times, about a piece he wrote from the wilds of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, this past weekend, because it's tough duty. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Brutal, I know. He's on the line now. We're going to bring him directly in and do the news fix later in the show. Basically, we were both gobsmacked. It was the kind of story that you paste in Slack with, "This is all caps fascinating." Apparently, at the Federal Reserve's annual meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, this big idea came up, this thing that a lot of us have been talking about, the idea that even though the economy seems to be great, there are still these stubborn issues, primarily around wage stagnation, and that there might be an explanation in tech and business trends and in scale. The fact that companies are so big and powerful now that they actually transcend and even override economic policy.
So, Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent in the New York Times. We got him on the phone. Hey, Neil.
Kai, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for doing this with us. I'm going to climb right in here and ask you sort of the introductory question, which is the thrust of this discussion that the Fed had out in Jackson Hole, and we should say the Federal Reserve gathers every year out in Jackson Hole to talk big economic concepts. And this year, one of the things, and the subject of your piece, was that maybe the Amazons and the Googles of this economy are getting so big that they are actually affecting the economy. First of all, do I have that take right?
Yeah, that's right. What we see is an economy that's more and more concentrated among a few very powerful companies. And for the first time, you know, I've been going to this conference off and on for 10 years. I've never seen these kinds of topics being discussed as a major driver of overall economic results. You know, why is wage growth low? Why is inflation low? All of these types of things. That's what was new in Jackson Hole this year. These are mainstream economists, very powerful policymakers from around the world saying, you know, holy moly, this concentration of corporate power really might matter.
Wow. Well, I feel like in some ways, isn't that sort of like welcome to the conversation that all the rest of us have been having? I mean, what caused this kind of wake up call?
Look, I think it's the combination of all this, you know, this very slow recovery over many years. Finally picking up a little bit. But, you know, look at all the trends we see. We see weak wage growth. We see low inflation. We see low interest rates. We see low business investment. And, you know, even in an environment where things are basically pretty good. For example, I talked to Esther George, the president of the Kansas City Fed, who's the host of the conference. And they picked this topic because she said, you know, I've been looking at these trends around, low lending to small businesses and wondering, maybe it's the concentration of the banking industry on Wall Street among these huge banks that's causing weak lending to small businesses. So there are all these areas where I think it's fair to say they're a little late to the party, but where there's growing evidence that what happens with individual companies and how they compete, how they pay people actually do matter.
Okay, so what's the evidence then, right? If they're observing this happen, what do they point to and say, this is why, and this is why, and this is why?
Well, I think the interesting part is around the labor market. And I think there's a real strong body of evidence that keeps getting stronger by the day, that what happens with competition actually does matter for workers and labor markets and pay compensation. So think of it this way. So suppose you're a nurse in a city, and there's five hospitals in that city. When there's five hospitals, they're going to compete for you to work there, and they might offer raises and bonuses and better hours to get the best people, and they'll compete for nurses, and that's good for you. But if those five hospitals, if they merge and form one hospital company, suddenly there's only one employer, and there's really only one place you can work, and that one place you can work has a lot more power over you than when there were five hospitals. And that type of thing has happened, and that's not even a fake example. That's actually, there's some pretty good empirical research around the hospital industry and what consolidation has meant for healthcare workers. So that's a real example.
One other thing you note in the piece is that there could be an Amazon effect that is not just about wages and investment spending, but also retail, like inflation, the idea that pricing might change very dramatically and that economic policy can't keep up. Can you explain that a little bit?
I mean, think about it this way. As you know, if you shop on Amazon and other online retailers, their prices change every day, multiple times a day. You know, the algorithms are always trying to find the optimal price and always adjusting. That has implications for inflation as a whole. So if suddenly the currency rises or falls, if suddenly gas prices rise, that's going to get passed through much more quickly to consumers. It's going to affect more people. So suppose you're in a place that, if you're a physical retailer, you might, if you're in a place that's depressed where the economy is really weak, you might keep prices low and you might raise them more in a place where the economy is doing better. The Amazons of the world are more likely to have the same prices no matter how your local economy is doing. So there are all these ways that, that just the nature of retail and how people buy things are going to affect how the economy actually works.
Now that the Fed is on the record, Neil, as knowing about this and realizing it and pointing it out as a problem, I feel obliged to mention here that the Fed doesn't really have any tools with which to combat this problem, right? This is way, way outside the dual mandate, right, of steady prices and full employment.
Yeah, the way I would think of it is, look, as you say, the Fed's job is to set the money supply and try and have maximum employment and stable prices. But if the ways things are working in the business world make it harder to do that, then they have to adapt. It's true. It's absolutely true that they don't set antitrust policy, and they're not going to go in and say, oh, you got to break up your hospital monopoly because it's affecting wages. But it is something they need to keep in mind when they're determining their policy. And, one argument, for example, we heard from Alan Krueger out in Jackson Hole, which, as you suggest, is not exactly hazard pay, but a very nice place to visit. Alan Krueger, the Princeton economist, was arguing if this is a real phenomenon, maybe the Fed keeping rates lower for longer is going to give workers more power and help shift that balance a little bit. So nobody expects the Fed to be deciding what happens with individual industries, but they have some power there.
So Krueger, sorry, if I could just jump back in here, Molly. Krueger's a former Obama administration Council of Economic Advisors guy. This is, though, a non-denominational issue, though, right?
I think it is. I don't, there's an open question around how much Washington is taking this seriously in the kind of current political environment. But I think if you look in the long term, I think the fact that both kind of nonpartisan, central banker types, as well as really a growing swath of the left. And I've heard some elements of this discussion on the right, too. You know, you've seen that even just in the last few days with conservatives being wary of the amount of power that social networks and big tech has over our public debates. It's a slightly different issue, but it's not altogether different either. You know, I think there is a growing concern across the ideological spectrum that we've ended up in an economy that's dominated by a handful of powerful organizations in ways that we didn't really know what was happening at the time. It kind of happened without anybody, you know, really raising the alarm bells. But the result may not be satisfying in a lot of different ways.
Well, and yet, though, I mean, I think on the flip side, you could say even if there's that awareness, there still is a pretty slavish devotion to anti-regulatory policy, to create, you know, to continuing to create the conditions. I mean, you see it in the corporate tax cut, which seems to be manifesting primarily as stock buybacks. Like, you really see this, the regulatory policy playing out in a way that only increases the power of these big players.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that current Trump administration policy tends to be highly favorable to business, whether that's around enforcement of labor laws, whether that's around banking regulation, in a lot of big areas. I'm not so much making anything predictive about what's going to happen to policy in the next couple of years. I'm saying if you look at the where all the energy is around these discussions, I think it's shifted in a decisive way just in the last 3-4 years toward a certain skepticism of kind of the world we've ended up in, where, you know, there's 4 major airlines, there's, you know, a handful of major banks that dominate the banking industry. You can go down the list of industries that are concentrated in ways that, that just make people nervous.
Do you think it's possible, Neil, that the Great Recession took the Fed's eye off the ball? Because Amazon's a 20-year-old company, and it's been growing gangbusters, right? And Google's been around for a good long while. And oh, by the way, there was this existential crisis, and we had to deal with that first?
Absolutely. I think as we look at the recession, and, you know, it was so deep, it was so long, it was such a challenge to get out of it, that I think so much focus has been on the cyclical getting the economy back on track for the last 10, 12 years, certainly the Fed, but it also among other economic policymakers. If you go back to the first term of the Obama administration, so much of their focus was on trying to get out of this pit that we were in rather than trying to think about the long-term structure of the economy, that it kind of, we had to get to a certain level of stability in the economy before we could turn around and say, well, what happened here? I mean, I mentioned banking earlier. Part of the reason the banking industry is so consolidated is because that was the strategy of the financial crisis response, is, you know, force big banks to merge with each other and put the weak in the hands of the strong. And that just kind of happened. You know, the further we get into full employment, the further we get away from the crisis and the recession, the more we're looking at these long-term issues that have really potentially been restraining wages and having a lot of other effects that that aren't too satisfying.
Do you have any sense of what the levers are? It's funny because when we talk about, you know, when we talk about Facebook, for example, and the effect of social networks on discourse or governments, or, you know, it feels like it's this transnational situation that these companies have so much power and that all the solutions end up helping them and hurting the little guys. Like, we could raise the federal minimum wage, but that would put small businesses out of business. What levers do you hear people talking about?
I mean, it's tough. Look, the simplest ones are around antitrust, but that might require new laws, certainly new judicial interpretations. You know, it's much harder to kind of unwind some of these mega companies now that they're in place than it was to than it would have been earlier on. You know, look, as you look at history, it's not that it's never been done, though. There's the AT&T breakup in the 1980s. You know, even the case against Microsoft in the 1990s, Microsoft didn't ultimately break up, but it did kind of move more cautiously entering the search business and mobile and some other areas. So it's not that there are no tools to be used in those areas. There's also, you know, as we heard from Alan Krueger and others in Jackson Hole, there's the idea of kind of other countervailing power in the economy. So, you know, if labor unions were more powerful, then that would be a countervailing force. If you know, if the Fed runs the economy hot and workers have more power because there's a shortage of them, that might shift the balance a little.
What's interesting, though, about this political moment, right, and certainly in the economy as well, is there aren't a whole lot of countervailing forces anywhere.
Right.
There is a lot of big forces, a lot of big loud forces, but no countervailing forces.
But one assumes it's always, maybe I'm just trying to be hopeful, one assumes it's always a pendulum, right, that something gets so big it inevitably topples over.
Yeah, and then the pendulum swings the other way.
I do think what's striking is if Democrats were to take power in 2020 or 24 or whenever it may be, we'll see what happens with congressional majorities even before then. You know, the tenor of the debate, especially among the Democratic Party, is completely different than it was when Obama was elected, even when Hillary Clinton got the nomination 2 years ago. So how those debates shape up and where power actually lies is an open question. I'm certainly not sitting here predicting that we're about to see, you know, major industries be ripped apart and mega corporations split up. We're a long way from that. But I think what there is a kind of deep awareness that this concentration is an issue that matters to all of us.
Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent at The New York Times. Neil, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your time, man.
Guy, thanks as always.
All right, take it easy.
Thanks, Neil.
So there you go. Let us know what you think about what Neil said. I first of all, go read his article and then look up the word monopsony, by the way, which yes. We didn't get into, but that's fine. That'll give you all something to do. And then tell us what you think. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Molly's on Twitter now that she's back from vacation, at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rosdahl. I did not get off Twitter when I was on vacation. Shame on me. Let us know what you think. I mean, it's kind of thought-provoking, right? Because I, for one, enjoy my Amazon next-day delivery. I'm just saying. Right?
Yeah, that's funny because I'm starting to reconsider my Amazon next day delivery.
Are you really?
Yes.
Are you? Wow. Good for you. You're a better person than I am.
The Bay Area is the first place in America to get in its feelings about everything. And so currently there is this sense that we're all in our feelings about Amazon and we just don't think it's a good thing. And maybe we don't want to use it. And I've become a little bit infected. Yeah, it's really, plus they raise their Prime prices anyway. Please get in on this conversation because it is indeed all caps fascinating. We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, we're going to fixate on some more stuff.
I like that little style guide there. It's all caps.
All caps.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. And if you were worried that there wasn't going to be a news fix, you were wrong.
Yep. All right, who's good? You going first or am I going first?
All right, I'm going to go first on what I think is a slightly related, actually a totally related topic that I think is really interesting because we're having all these conversations about capitalism, again, what's happening with the economy, whether companies are controlling things to such an extent that it is damaging to the economy itself. And then on top of that, just this week, a group of scientists appointed by the UN Secretary General and affiliated with GMO, a global investment management firm, essentially reported that capitalism is why we have climate change. But all of that is also related to inequality, unemployment, slow economic growth, rising debt levels, impotent governments, and that fundamentally, like, we will destroy ourselves as a planet and a society if we continue along the capitalist path that we're on right now. It's a little dark. It was a little dark.
Happy Tuesday, everybody.
Think about what a crazy, I don't know, it's more like, think about what a point we have arrived at when a UN-appointed panel of scientists, when an actual investment firm is involved in putting out a research report that just makes no bones about it, says, the problem is that we have this short-term profit-motivated thinking that has nothing to do with social good, and that system is completely unequipped to deal with the workings of the global economy as it is now and the crises that it has created.
So what's the answer? Because capitalism might be the worst form of, you know, economic theory yet invented, except for all the others.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, if I can get all Churchillian on you here.
But like, it was invented just like every other system. So some new system may need to be invented, or some new hybrid system. There was also, I was fixated for a while on that Times op-ed that said that maybe China's version of capitalism, where the government directs the priorities of capitalism, maybe some version of that is what will work better. I don't really know. I'm fascinated with the fact, all caps fascinated, with the fact that this is a conversation we are for real starting to have. And by we, I mean our larger society and apparently, you know, the greatest economic minds in the world. And what's going to be interesting is that, like, there will at some point be an actual business case for reforming capitalism, because otherwise we all die.
I wonder what the business case for reforming capitalism is, right? I mean, if you could get five of the smartest people from, the Harvard Business School or whatever, draw that business case up for me, would you? See what that sounds like.
Yeah. And then come on the show.
We should just pay them and commission that.
That would be such a make me smart thing to do.
It totally would. We obviously don't have the money to pay somebody to do that, but we should actually have Shara call around and say, listen, what's the business case for reforming capitalism? And totally. It's got to be like substantive and real. It can't be, you know, companies have to do good, right? That's not reforming capitalism, right?
Nope.
Can we
literally has
that?
To be okay. The business case. All right. And is it, you know, is it that it's diminishing returns? Like, what is it? And then can we have a roundtable? Let's have a roundtable. Let's do a new kind of episode.
All right.
It's going to be
so
awesome.
It's a little project.
Guys.
Here. It's a little project.
Yep. All right. What you got? What you got, Kai?
So I got this morning. I'm a little newsier, I think, just because I'm you know, whatever. This thing from the president this morning complaining about Google skewing search results to keep him out of the news. And then there's that, right, which is not entirely aligned with reality. But then Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, coming out to the White House driveway an hour later and saying, yes, the White House is looking at whether Google searches ought to be regulated.
Yeah.
So how Mr. Kudlow does that work, sir? But also, it goes to something you and I have talked about, right? This idea of regulating some of these big companies that are internet dependent, and how that ought to happen. And I just think it's bananas, first of all, that the president said that, right? But the idea that nobody at the White House said, I'm sorry, sir, what? That just got me.
This one episode, more than almost any other episodes, should show why, for example, Google should not introduce a censored search product in India or China.
In China, right. Yeah, exactly. Which they are doing.
Exactly. And why the internet must, in fact, remain free and open. Because if it is not, then the natural inclination of law enforcement, human rights activists, governments, politicians who feel maligned by the media, as all of them do. This is not a new phenomenon with our current president. All of them have every interest, self-interest, in regulating the speech of the internet. And so the more those tools are available or made available or created or deployed, the worse it's going to get.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's just really interesting. It's just really, really
fascinating.
Interesting. And it's, you know. Whether anything will change, and, you know, obviously there's the whole political thing that's involved with the president and him saying many, 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 many of the things that he says. But this one is just, I thought, was fascinating.
Yes. Just the idea that it says, hey, I want to censor these search results to make them more favorable to me.
Right.
That's a troubling trend. Just saying.
All right. Where do we go? We go to your turn now, yeah? Little mailbox thing? Hit it.
Dear Make Me Smart.
This is Jess from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I'm David Stork of Portola Valley, California.
I'm a doctoral candidate.
I'm getting married this November.
I work for a Fortune 500 company.
All right. Eric Olson is a music teacher. He's noticing the same wage trends that Neil was just talking about with us. And he sent us this voice memo. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I've been wondering about our current American economy. We're in a weird, awesome place where everything's firing on full cylinders, and we're nearly full employment, the stock market's booming, and everyone seems to be doing great. Yet, businesses aren't raising wages at all, and everything seems to be kind of stuck. In the private sector, why can't businesses that are doing so well raise their wages to attract new hires or expand? Is there any correlation between all of this? Anyway, I don't know. I'm just a music teacher. Love the show.
So music teachers matter, man.
I know. Seriously, come on. Hey, pro tip, you guys. Did you know that on Donors Choose, which I used to fund my sister-in-law's public school teaching career, basically, year after year, you can set up a recurring donation to a classroom? I'm just saying.
Oh, well, that's cool.
You should freaking do it.
That's cool.
Because I live in a town where our school system's falling apart. Anyway, the good news for Eric is that we pretty much just answered this question in some ways above. Yeah. But I really wanted to talk about it because we also, just today, as we're recording this, in fact, just very few minutes before we started recording, consumer confidence numbers came out. And they're like, supposedly, the highest they've been in 18 years. Consumers feel great about the labor market, and they're taking out all this debt. And never mind the other data that said they can't buy a house. Like, what's, I don't, because it feels like everybody feels this one way, but also this other way. Yeah, help.
Right. So here's what's going on, and it's all aspirational, right? When you look at those consumer confidence numbers, the questions generally are, how are you feeling about your economic prospects 6 to 12 months from now? And people are looking around and seeing unemployment's way down and the stock market's up. Let me insert my caveat here. The stock market is not the economy. The economy is not the stock market, close parentheses, right? But people are looking forward saying, you know what? I just think things are going to get better. I think things are going to get better because the headline numbers are up. And yes, you know what? Maybe they haven't had a huge wage increase, but their pay has gone up 2%, a little bit more than 3% actually, year on year, which doesn't keep up with inflation, but they're not seeing inflation. They're seeing, hey, I got a little bit more money, right? And look, none of it's the way it's supposed to be. And workers are not getting the benefit of most of the benefit in this economy happening right now. But my sense is people are feeling aspirational about it, and that's why they're answering those consumer confidence surveys the way they are. That's my gut. That's where I am.
No, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Well, and it might be some kind of leftover faith and trickle down that if these companies are doing so well, it seems to follow based on everything that we have been told that the benefits would trickle down. Yeah. All right. Next up from you guys, Diego Lapidus has some other ideas on how inequality could affect our markets. He writes, is it possible that we're reaching a situation where there's enough inequality to create such a division in markets that inflation applies completely differently to markets for the 95% to 99% of the population, and then a different inflation level for the most wealthy?
Well,
that seems
like
that's exactly what's happening, right?
Well, right. And the more money you have, the less you care that a gallon of gas costs $3.75 instead of $3.25, right? And the gallon of milk has gone up a nickel, right? I mean, that's the issue with income inequality in this country, right? Is that the wealthy have the disposable income so that it doesn't matter how much a gallon of gas costs. Inflation hits everybody, but only affects some people. That's the thing.
And then that's why there are those arguments that, for example, the gas tax is regressive in some ways because it hits poor people the hardest.
Yeah. Not in some ways.
Commuter taxes. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. So, yes, you are correct, Diego. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex Baker, seen a whole lot of stagnant wages in his job as well, and he's got an idea about why it is. Here he is.
Hey there, Make Me Smart. Something that keeps getting brought up is why aren't wages growing? And one of the questions I have is how many people are taking seriously non-unionized workers? As someone who's only worked low-level service jobs in lifeguarding, and now as a customer service rep at an airport, the overwhelming impression I get is that owners and management does not care about workers. My manager might, but if an owner is not interacting with the lower-level workers, they refuse to raise wages while also increasing workload.
Alex actually went on in that voicemail to tell us that there is nearly 73% turnover at his job. Yeah, which is intense. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a real, especially as these companies get so large, actually, that seems to make a lot of sense that there's no way for the people at the top, you know, short of appearing on Undercover Boss, to truly understand the roles of the people who work in those organizations, what they do, how long it takes them, and what they need to accomplish their jobs. Not to mention, though, just profit squeezing.
And the role of organized labor in this economy and its decline cannot be overemphasized, right? Or underemphasized.
It really can't.
Or I forget which it is. But anyway, there you go.
Overstated.
There you go.
Overstated.
Yes, overstated. Right.
Yes.
Exactly. All right. A whole lot of labor, a whole lot of wages, a whole lot of big companies and their effect on the economy in the podcast. Let us know what you think. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us your thoughts, because this is like real stuff. And also, oh, by the way, as we head into an election, it's going to become more real, because you're going to start hearing more about the economy, I think, as we approach 2020. But
it's the economy, stupid. It's never anything but that. Yep. Don't kid yourselves.
Oh, there's the music.
See you next
They're giving
week.
Us the music cue hook.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you know, the music cue hook, right? Here's what we want you to do. Go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and just share. Share the podcast. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Troh. Tony Wagner is the digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay. Also, Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. And the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I feel bad that you had to do the long one, since you had to do them all for like 3 weeks.
Yeah, no, I know. It's all right. It wasn't so bad. And amazingly enough, I filled the time. So, you know, while you were off gallivanting around doing whatever you're doing.
Gallivanting. There was a little bit of gallivanting, that's true.
Yes, there should be.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.